General Richards, Reel 3, take it up from the cavalry charge.
Well, as I said, the cavalry charged through the Turkish lines, and the Turks threw up their arms, their hands, and surrendered. And then the cavalry tactics are to reassemble the other side of the line and come through again. Well, of course, what happened really was that as soon as they charged over the ridge and so on, the Turks had lying back a lot of machine guns and opened fire on these cavalry fellows when they were reassembling to come back again. And the result was they suffered very heavy casualties. In fact, practically every British officer was killed or wounded. And they got back in the end, and the Turks, who had surrendered, of course, decided they wouldn't surrender, so another collected. And General Harbord was seriously considering withdrawing because he was so weak and so on. He was hiding behind a stone wall, and more or less when he made up his mind that we'd have to withdraw and so on, we looked up and saw that the Turks were withdrawing. And so we stayed where we were. And 2 days later, we were told, when I say we, I mean like our patrols, were told to advance. It might have been the next day, as far as I remember, advance and make contact with the Turks again. And we found them about 17 miles away. And we had a few skirmishes going on there. And then this was about the 30th of November, October, and we suddenly heard that there was an armistice. So the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting part of it, or backlog on that, was rather interesting, really, because when I found myself at the Staff College in 1934, there were two Iraqi officers there, and I was discussing this situation with one of them, and this fella, one of them, had been on the hill which we'd been trying to capture about 17 miles away. And he remembered an incident quite well.
That's interesting.
Rather interesting. Then, when the armistice came, we had to go through to Alexandretta. And I was fortunate one to go through and so on. And about 5 miles further on, there was Kemal Pasha, the German commander, the Turkish commander-in-chief, standing on the side of the road watching us. And so that was the end of that battle.
Yes. There was one question that I wanted to ask you. Going back a bit, during the long advance north up through Palestine, given the kind of force you had with its mixture of horsed units, armored car units, light car units, as well as infantry. Did you have any problems of setting the right pace and keeping coordinated as a force?
Well, no, we didn't really, because our jobs were just merely reconnoitering the flanks and so on, and making quite sure they were safe. And we would halt in these places until we found that the cavalry were coming through all right, then we'd go on to the next. So there was no difficulty about that at all. But when we evacuated Syria in 1919, handed over to the French, I did advance guard there and to the cavalry, and I'd do my 15 to 20 miles a day in about an hour. So I spent the remainder of the day shooting sandgrouse and so on around the place until the cavalry caught up. And that was the advantage of being in the mechanical unit.
Yes. What were relations like between you people on the mechanical side and those on the cavalry side? Is it a good relationship?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Any sort of professional rivalry?
Don't think so, no. No, we're all great friends.
In the operational experiences you had during the Palestine operations, given that, apart from this one German armored car that you've mentioned, given that there were no mechanized forces on the enemy side, How effective were your own when you came up against
What effective are
terrorists?
our own armoured cars and so on?
Yes.
They were very effective because the moral effect was much greater than the physical effect. The moral effect on the Turks was terrific, really. They saw armoured cars and so on. They had no antidote. That was a snag, rather than their point of view. You only had to appear with an armoured car or two, and they usually threw up their hands in horror.
Can you give me any examples of that, just to sort of illuminate the point
No,
a
I
little?
can't. Can't think of any offhand.
Okie doke. Just to finish off this this period, taking it up to 1919, after the armistice and going into 1919, you were posted to
Aintab, yeah.
Aintab, I believe. During this period, what were the activities of the armoured cars and light car units?
Civil defence, really. Keeping the Armenians and the Turks quiet, because the Armenians and the Turks spent most of their time trying to cut one another's throats. And going to see that the countryside was really quiet. For instance, on one expedition, I had to go to a place called Urfa, which is in eastern Anatolia, where there was a missionary station, British or American, I've forgotten which, and the rumors were that they were being molested by the Turks. And so I had to take light car patrol because the ground was pretty difficult to offer armored cars, and we had to get across the Euphrates in flat-bottom boats, which we successfully did. We got to this place called Urfa, and we found the missionary station there, and I've forgotten the name of the woman in charge, and they were all very happy and contented and so on, so we came away. And the same thing happened in a place like in Aintab. There was a British missionary there, a woman called Miss Frierson, I think her name was, and she had this missionary station which taught the Turkish girls, how to make sew and things like that. And they're all quite very happy. No trouble at all.
How often did you become involved in civilian disturbances during this tail end of your period in Syria?
None at all. We would have to, in a lot of cases, escort lots of Armenians. In one case, we escorted a large convoy of Armenians from Aleppo to Alexandretta. And we had to escort them because the Turks would beat them up otherwise. And it was a very difficult thing to do because you only had about four armored cars and things like that. And the convoy of these people walking would be probably 4 or 5 miles long, so you couldn't protect them, and nor could you stop them raiding Turkish villages for food and so on. It was extremely difficult, and we used to have an awful lot of trouble in that way, trying to keep the peace. But I did have one bit of trouble, which is rather interesting. We camped one night near an old Turkish fort, and there were a few rooms there, and I had one room, and I used to have an Armenian in charge of the whole convoy, you see, his own people, because I couldn't speak their language. And one evening we were fired on by somebody, and we sent a party around. We captured a couple of these fellows who'd been firing at us, and I told the Armenians to lock them up in a room in this fort. And so we're starting off early next morning. I turned around to the head boy, and I said to him, I said, you better let those Turks go. let them push off, take the rifles away from them, which I'd done, of course. And so he said, oh, he said, they're gone already. I said, well, that's right, I didn't worry more about it, did he? Anyway, about a fortnight or 3 weeks later, I was called to headquarters and said, asked me about this incident. Well, I said, that's what happened as far as I was concerned. He said, what happened really was, in the night, these two Turks had been murdered by the Armenians and buried. And our friend Kemal Pasha wanted the officer concerned to be taken to Edna and court-martialed.
That was you?
That was me. However, General McAndrew thought that was a good deal of rubbish and so on, and I heard no more about it.
In this strange kind of civilian peacekeeping role, did you find that armoured cars and light cars were actually suitable for that kind of work?
Oh yes, very, yes, very, yes. The moral effect of them was great, you see. Mm-hmm. I mean, in those days, there was very little mechanical transport about. Very little.
Now, after the war was over and you got back to England, did you still have a direct interest in continuing to work with mechanized forces?
Well, what happened really was I got back to England in about March 1920, and after a month's holiday, I was told to report to a place called Shorncliffe in Kent. And I arrived there, and they had a kind of machine gun corps depot there, which consisted of machine gun corps infantry, machine gun corps cavalry, and machine gun corps motors. And I was the motor portion of it, honestly. And they honestly didn't know what to do with me, I don't think, because there wasn't going to be any more machine gun corps being disbanded. And I was really seconded from the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And as I'd never been with the Royal Welsh Fusiliers for except 5 minutes during the war, I wasn't feeling very keen on going back there because I wouldn't be well received. Anyway, I waited in Shorncliffe for some time, and then after about a couple of months there, I was told to report to Bovington. And so I joined the 4th Tank Battalion at Wareham. And there I found being formed two armored car companies to go out to Egypt. And I joined the 7th Armored Car Company. And we left not to Egypt, to India. And we left for India in January 1921.
Mm-hmm. That short period you had at Bovington and Wareham, you were being mixed up, presumably, mostly with other people who'd been transferred from other regiments into tanks on a wartime.
We were all various regiments, even the men and the officers. We all belonged to various regiments. My commanding officer was an ex-Leinster regiment. And the second in command was a QSB, and so on and so on. There were some gunners there, and that fellow I was telling you about, who lived in Isha, was a gunner. And it was a complete mixture. The men were the same.
Were they all there by virtue of wanting in their post-war careers to carry on serving with tanks and armored cars?
No, they weren't, because most of them had never been in tanks or armored cars before. Hardly any of them had been with armored cars or tanks. They were practically all people who, I think, wanted a bit of change from their regiments. In some cases, like my commanding officer, his regiment had been disbanded. We had a lot of Leinster fellows, other ranks with us, because they'd all been disbanded, you know, after the Irish Troubles.
At this time, what was... What was the attitude to tanks of this particular group of people? I mean, did they think that tanks were going to be important in the post-war army and that they had a future with that arm? Or
what? Oh, I think so, yes. They're all very keen. They're very fine fellows indeed. Excellent chaps, the whole lot of them were. And we went out to India as an armored car company, and we took over Rolls-Royce armored cars there, and they fell into the niche very well indeed. I think they're all very keen.
I'm sorry to keep you at Wareham, because I know you weren't there very long, and perhaps you don't remember much about it, but I'm just interested in what kind of state of morale Tank Corps personnel were in those months immediately following the First World War.
Well, I got to Wareham, and there's a fellow called Burgess Short commanding the battalion, and Colonel Carlton was second in command, and I should have thought morale is remarkably high, because we had some very fine athletes there, a fellow called Wilson and a fellow called Black, who were Olympic athletes, you see, and people like that kept the morale up tremendously when there wasn't very much else to look forward to. Mm.
In that period that you were with the 4th Battalion, had things become sufficiently stabilized for the battalion to have got into a routine training program? Or
oh, yes. We had our Mark V heavy tanks from the war, and we all trained with these tanks, and we took them to they eventually went to Lulworth to fire and things like that. Oh, yes, it was a very, very well coordinated unit.
This would have been your first experience with tanks as such.
Oh, yeah.
What was the system of routine training? I mean, what happened to you personally?
How I personally took over a section of tanks in the battalion, Mark V tanks, and we just trained on these tanks. We did individual training, collective training, and so on. Mm. And then we then found these armored car companies being formed for India, and we were busy getting our leave in and organize ourselves to take over these armored cars in India.
In your short period of training with the tanks, what form did the individual training take? What kind of drills? And
drills, we do a gunnery drill and maintenance on the tanks and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Could you detail that a bit for me?
Well, it's awfully difficult to detail because, I mean, the gun drill, we had our 6-pounders each side. I think there were 6-pounders on the inside, and you had your these guns were on stands outside under a cover or in a shed, and you just did this gun drill with them and so on. And then we would, there's a lot of maintenance to be done on these Mark V tanks. We would probably more or less take the engines out and take the differentials out and things like that, overhaul them. They were in constant need of repair because, they were pretty new affairs to start with, experimental, more or less, and we're always having track trouble and things like that. We'd have to break the tracks and repair them and so on. We're constantly doing all these mechanical affairs. We did very little foot drill, anything like that.
After the freedom and mobility of serving with light car units, you must have found the pace and ponderousness of heavy tanks quite a contrast.
Oh, it was, yes. Oh, yes. But it was very interesting because there were tremendously interesting bits of mechanism, you know, really, the enormous Ricardo engines in the middle of them and so on. And you had a crew of 5 or 6 in the tank, and each fellow had his duty, and you had your duty and so on. It was very interesting, really.
How well was Lulworth adapted for gunnery training at this time in 1920?
Oh, I should, from my small lieutenant point of view, I should have thought very well organized.
What kind of facilities were there?
Well, we went there and we would go into camp, bell tents and so on, and there was an officer's mess where we'd feed, and we had the ranges there, and we carried out our firing there. That's what we did, really. all the individual firing and collective firing on the ranges. You would have to fire your Hotchkiss machine guns and your 2-pounder, your 6-pounders.
One of the reasons I'm so interested in this period is because I think that immediately after the war, from what one can read, there was a quite prevalent feeling that tanks were things which happened in the peculiar circumstances of trench warfare, and that once the war was over, they probably wouldn't be of much use or value anymore. And well, I just wonder whether that kind of feeling was apparent to you at that time.
No, it wasn't apparent to us, nor to anybody in the regiment, as far as I know. It was only apparent, I think, to people like the infantry and the cavalry. It wasn't apparent to us at all. We always thought we were the ones for the future. And, I mean, we got a lot of very fine officers, and I think they came to us for the same reason. We had a fellow called George Lindsay from the Rifle Brigade, and a fellow called Pyle, who just died, from the Gunners, and so on. And they're all very fine fellows, and they wouldn't have come along if there hadn't been any future in it.
The formation of the armored car companies, 7th and 8th at Wareham, which you became involved in, I suppose that was partly because you would have been one of the few people with armored car experience.
I might have been. I don't know how I got into that, really. I suppose I volunteered. I just don't know how I got into it. But none of the other people had any armoured car experience in it. I was the only one.
You were sent to Rolls-Royce at Derby for a training course. Can you tell me in a bit of detail about that course?
All we did, yes, it was a rather interesting course, really. It was a kind of chauffeur's course. And another fellow and myself joined this course, and we had with us chauffeurs from Sassoon and the Duke of Westminster and things like that. And we did a mechanical course where we were taught all about the engine and the differential and things like that, and shown all around the works in great detail, and taken out to drive and things like that, and shown how to drive properly and so on. And the course, I think, lasted a fortnight or 3 weeks. Most interesting.
And did you then have to return to Wareham to train other personnel on armoured cars?
No, because we hadn't got any armoured cars until we got to India.
Oh, I see.
You see, we picked up our armoured cars in India.
When you joined the 7th Armoured Car Company at Peshawar in January 1921, was the equipment of the company much the same as the Rolls-Royce equipment that you were familiar with from working in Egypt and Palestine?
Exactly the same.
Hadn't changed?
No, it changed. Just the armoured cars were just the same. Except they were trying different tyres. They tried things like natural air pressure tyres and things like that to avoid puncturing by bullets. They were never a great success. Then they had tyres which if you drilled a hole through them, they had liquid inside, so they filled the hole up and so on. That was not a success either. Otherwise, the equipment, it was just the same.
Yes, I see. Your responsibilities with the 7th Armoured Car Company were what exactly?
Mine were workshop. Yeah. After being Rolls-Royce, my job was a workshop, looking after the and maintaining the cars. When we got out there, the cars hadn't been touched for a long time, and we had to overhaul them. And I had a team of fitters, which I more or less taught myself. And we went around the companies. We had one section of them in Quetta, which was miles away. So we had to spend about 3 months in Quetta overhauling the cars there, which we didn't. And then we had our proper workshops in Peshawar.
What were the most common kinds of technical problems that you were faced with?
Well, the technical problems really were the valves were wanted grinding in, and carbon on the top of the cylinders, and just things like that. Electrical troubles. Otherwise, from the engine point of view alone, like bearings and so on, and the crankshaft, they were usually in pretty good order.
Were there any mechanical problems that arose as a result of the kind of conditions the cars had to operate in?
No, I don't think so.
They stood up to the sort of work they were given.
Yes.
The operations in Peshawar when you were there, you told me were mainly involved guarding roads and working parties and things like that. Did you develop any particular techniques, tactics for using armoured cars for this sort of purpose?
I don't think so. I don't think anything special. I mean, the convoys that we guarded were usually camel convoys or something like that. And you just merely picketed the road. And one car would be in front leading the road and then one car behind and a couple of cars pitting in dangerous spots and so on. There's nothing much in it, and you didn't have to move more than about 20 miles a day, you see. So it was pretty simple.
Did you become involved in any hostile actions at all?
No, I don't know, never did. No. I used to have rather comic occasion where I was sitting on the side of the road and I was slapped on the back by one of these Afridi fellows and say, "How do you do, Bo?" And I looked up and I said, "Where'd you learn that from?" And he said, "Oh," he said, he goes to Australia occasionally." I said, "Whatever you go to Australia for?" He said, "I go to Australia to buy horses." And one of them had an Australian wife. And she was trudging along with the others quite happily.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
You returned to England and to the 4th Battalion again at the beginning of 1924. Was the battalion still based at Wareham then?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And after about a while, about 6 months or so on, we moved to Bovington for a short period because I think the camp at Wareham was being pulled down. And we were in ordinary huts there. And from Bovington, we then moved to Catterick in 1925.
I see.
The period in Wareham and Bovington were just merely gunnery and mechanical periods, doing courses at D&M school and the gunnery school and so on. We did very little, if any, what you might call tactical training. We still had the same commanding officer, Burgess Short, who commanded the regiment or the battalion in those days for 7 years. Mm-hmm. You see? Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't add to doesn't help for promotion.
How well prepared was Catterick to receive the battalion when you made the move?
Oh, it was all there. We moved to Catterick and all the sheds were there and everything was complete, ready for us. I think it had just been put up for us.
How did the comforts and facilities at Catterick compare with Wareham? Was it improvement?
No, I don't think it was. I shouldn't have thought of any improvement at all. The snag was, from the other rank point of view, there was no town. Richmond was the nearest place, which was about 2 miles away. And there wasn't very much doing in Richmond. And the only place they could get to was Darlington, which was some 14 or 15 miles away.
I see. By the time you came back to the 4th Battalion, one significant change which had taken place in the Tank Corps was that the Corps was now taking officers by direct entry as opposed to transfers from other regiments.
Yes, that's right.
When you returned to the battalion, did you find that this new development had changed the type or quality of the personnel that were coming into the Corps?
I think it probably did a little. There were some of the subaltern officers getting a bit old because of lack of promotion and so on, so they were getting a bit stale. And we got these young fellows from Sandhurst and so on who were enthusiastic, and I think it did improve matters considerably in that way. And we were getting a very good type of young officer. coming to the regiment. And it might have helped in that way, but otherwise I think life was much the same. We did do a good deal of tactical training, which we hadn't done before, and of course we had the new tank, which was the Vickers, Vickers tank.
On this personnel question, just before we go on, how numerous and influential were the officers who had served with tanks during the